Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Welcome to Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. This is the AA meeting on air. My name's Rebecca. I'm an alcoholic and I'll be chairing the meeting today. Today we have with us some lovely people from the Wellington Saturday Morning Plimoton Third Step Group. So they meet at 8:30 on Saturday mornings in Plimoton. I'm going to start with the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Now the Plimoton group starts with the third step prayer, so I'm going to pass over to Janine now, who will lead us with the third step prayer.
Hi, I'm Janine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt.
Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may be a witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Janine. And I'm going to pass over to Martin to start off the sharing.
My name's Martin. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to you. I began my life existence in a little country in Africa where I grew up on a farm. And for about the first 5 or 6 years of my life, the only people that were around me were my parents and my brother. And so I wasn't very socially equipped when I started to go to school. In fact, in the first year of school, my parents homeschooled me, so I didn't even get to mix with other kids. The result was I didn't feel that comfortable when I went to school. On top of that, of course, my parents sent me to boarding school, which I spent 11 years doing. So there was a rather limited scope for me to be able to be to feel part of the community. I wasn't very good at sports because my parents, again, living on the farm, there was no opportunity for me to do anything in the way of sports until I got to junior school. And then I found myself not as well equipped as others to do anything in the physical line. That immediately put me on my back foot because I really didn't feel that I belonged anywhere. But I managed to get over that when I got to senior school. I also learned to play the guitar. And when I was 16, I became a bass player for a local band, and we used to do public dances in rural sports clubs. And whenever you go to one of those clubs, the first thing everybody wants to do is buy the band a drink, an alcoholic drink. And at 16, I'd never drunk before, so I found myself with this line of beers down the stage at the end of an evening, which I felt compelled to drink to show my gratitude for the people who bought them for me. I didn't like beer, but I kind of forced myself to drink, which I think was the beginning for me, because I probably had a predisposition to alcoholism, but I didn't recognize it at the time, of course, because 2 beers and it was enough for me. Like all young men who go on to university, the drinking culture there is quite intense, and they don't drink for social purposes; they drink to get drunk. And a lot of us did that, and we always used to wake up in the morning and swear off alcohol forever. We'll never drink again until, of course, the next weekend. When I left university, in my country, we had an armed conflict going on. So the it was a done thing for all young men to be called up and do military service. Of course, war does put a lot of strain on people, and those of a lesser disposition find the only way they can cope is through blocking out the realities of that war, and that involved, of course, drinking. And there was a lot of heavy drinking. I fortunately did not succumb to that because I wasn't in the armed services for very long. I was pulled out and made a magistrate at the tender age of 23. But I was still, I would think, behaving normally at that stage in terms of what I consumed and what I, you know, how I behaved. But as I got towards the end of my 20s, I found that I was drinking a lot more. I was drinking out of turn. In other words, I was, instead of just going to the pub with the boys, I would go and drink at home. And I used to use the excuse that the stress of my job would compel me to do this. However, I look back on that now, and that was purely an excuse. The fact is, I think I was on a treadmill heading to nowhere. The effect it was having on me was that I would go to work sometimes feeling very, very fuzzy-headed, and I'm hoping, in fact, I'm pretty sure that it didn't affect the outcome of my work. But you know, we always think that we're okay like that. But I mean, how do we really know? After about 5 years on the bench, I decided to move into private practice as a legal practitioner. Now, bearing in mind, this is in Africa, where the legal systems are far different from what they are here in Australia or New Zealand. And I successfully practiced for about 2 to 3 years, but I could feel at that stage that something had changed. When I picked up a drink, it wasn't for the pleasure of it. It was to try and fill a gap. It was to try to make me feel better about my situation. I had just got married, and I just felt that my coping mechanism wasn't as good as it could have been if I hadn't been drinking. But I pursued on for another 4 or 5 years until eventually I got to the stage where I was picking up a drink in the morning. I was drinking during the day. I used to get up on an early Saturday morning and start drinking at 5 o'clock. And it was obviously becoming a 24/7. I was being warned by family members who were well-intentioned, by doctors who thought they knew a bit about alcoholism. And although there are many doctors who do know about alcoholism, a few of them don't really understand the really deep intricacies of it. And my one doctor said to me, well, here's some Rohypnol and some sleeping tablets, and that should help overcome your stress. But of course, anybody can tell you that Rohypnol together with alcohol is a recipe for disaster. And then my dear old mother-in-law would say to me, just stop at 2 drinks and you'll be fine. But of course, the treadmill was already going at high speed by then, and you can't take 2 drinks if you're an alcoholic, because the compulsive nature of alcoholism means once you start, you can't stop. But where things came to a head, because while I was in practice, one of my customers was an interesting gentleman who I could only describe as being a sociopath. He was very well dressed, and he was very well turned out and very well spoken, and gave the impression of being one of those altogether men. But I soon discovered, after representing him for one count of murder, one count of attempted murder, about 28 cases of bad debt and something else, that this man wasn't all that he made himself out to be. Because I was drinking, and because I didn't have the full presence of mind, I should have done what most other lawyers might have done, which was to tell him to go and find somebody else to represent him. However, he never ever confessed to me any of his crimes, so I was obliged by law until that time to carry on representing him. But ironically enough, with sociopaths, if you fall out with them, they build up a vendetta against you, and they will do anything to bring you down. And in a way, this was probably the beginning of my recovery, because he did everything he could to bring me down, including going to my doctor, my family, and the law society, as a result of which my doctor put me into a drying out ward. And that was my turning point. I've never tried to make amends to this guy, because I think he would be furious if I told him that it was because of him I'm now sober today, because that's exactly what the opposite of what he intended. But having got into that ward, I was lying in a ward for about 10 days. And for the first 5 days, I just didn't have the will to live. I didn't have any intention of killing myself. But on the other hand, I don't think I would have done anything to stop myself if I was in danger of dying. There was an open window next to my bed, and one of my friends said, "I'm looking at your face. I'm surprised you haven't leapt out of it." And this was on the second floor, so it would have been a bit nasty. But I was fortunate, because the first person that came to see me was a guy that I was at school with, and he made himself my sponsor. A little bit of a taskmaster, but he was patient with me, but he was also firm, and he insisted that I went to meetings every day, that I phoned him every day, that I wrote a list of what my life had become, and I wrote a whole list, about 4 pages, of why things had gone wrong and who was responsible. And he took one look at this and said, "This is rubbish. You must know that you are the problem, and now you must become the solution." And I was very fortunate there too, because when I went into the rooms, I found to my surprise there was at least 10 other people who I knew when I was still drinking, and I didn't know they were in the rooms. So I thought I must have been keeping bad company with all this lot. But the support I got from the rooms was very good, and I was able to, through my adult brain, understand that this was the place that I needed to be if I wanted to get my life back on track. So I patiently went through the steps. I patiently went to every meeting I could. I did a lot of 12-step work. I went into psych wards, and I went into other hospitals, and I did a lot of service at home. I sat on the local intergroup committee, ended up as chairperson of that too, and a treasurer. And I found that service is an essential part of your recovery. When I look back on it now, and it's nearly 30 years since I got sober, there's a lot of lessons to be learned. This is a journey, it's not a destination. You're always improving. And I used to say to myself, every day and every way, I get better and better. And I believe that, because even now today, I hear newcomers share, and I thought, well, I haven't looked at it like that before. We've all got our own walk in life, and we're a melting pot. All of us are from different backgrounds, different ethnic groups, different social groups and whatever, but we can learn from each other. And that's what I think gives us tolerance in society as a whole. My belief is that this AA program is not only a program for recovery, it's also a formula for life. And I carry that program into my social life, especially step 10. If I've done something wrong and it's clearly my fault, I will always admit it in a way that's not subservient, but to say, yes, I've done it. I think before I went into AA, I would never have done that. I would have tried to hide it, blame somebody else, do something, that was not the right thing to do. And today, when I look at it, I also acknowledge the fact that getting sober alone is not the whole story for you. You've got to continue to look after yourself and look after those around you, serve your group. I believe that there are 4 cornerstones to health. And apart from getting sober, which is the first step, is that you need to look after your diet, you need to look after your exercise regime, you need to get rest and recreation, and you need to have the right mental attitude. And we get taught that in AA. We look after ourselves. You learn to love yourself again, which you didn't do for years while you were drinking. But now I think I've got all those together and continue my journey as a happy, sober person. That's all from me.
Thanks, Martin. You're listening to the AA meeting on air on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. If you're listening to this and you sort of seem to be having trouble with your drinking, or if your drinking's reached the point where it worries you a bit enough to be listening to an AA broadcast, you might be interested in learning more about AA. We've got a fabulous website, aa.org.nz, where you can find out all kinds of things about AA and how it works. Now I'm going to pass on to Janine.
Hi, my name's Janine and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Janine.
And a very, very grateful sober and active member of AA of the last 2 years. I had a fairly good childhood, not a lot of alcohol around, and I always felt shy and never good enough. I think that's pretty standard for, you know, many alcoholics, just feeling like they don't fit in or they don't measure up, and that certainly was the case for me. My drinking didn't start early, and I can look back now and see that I drank to excess when I drank, but that was the normal kind of student parties and events. You know, I did drink too much, but I never had a compulsion to drink, on a regular basis. And and when I travelled, alcohol wasn't part of the equation at all. So things started getting worse in my 30s, and it's certainly not an excuse, but when I look back, my parents died 8 months apart, and I ended up inheriting an awful lot of bottles of spirits. And on top of the grief, I found that I started drinking the spirits, and fairly quickly was, just drinking out of the bottles. I wanted to blank what was going on in my life, and I was using alcohol to do it. And things carried on not going well for me. My marriage broke up, and within a few years I was picked up by an off-duty cop. It was the night before my birthday, and I was at my best friend's place. We had a big party, the two of us, and I decided I would drive home at the end of the night with my two young kids in the car. And I was weaving all over the road, apparently. It was just across the suburb, I thought. But he followed me and called the cops. I was too drunk to even realised that if I'd gone inside and shut the door, he couldn't have done anything. But, so I lost my licence. And it took me 17 years of things getting worse and worse and worse for me to find AA and realise that, I had a, I always felt like a victim, poor me, that this off-duty cop happened to be driving behind me that night. And now I think, my God, I could have killed my kids, killed other people, had an accident, anything. Thank goodness it wasn't worse. So I lost my license, and it cost me a lot, but I carried on drinking. And as things went on, I had more and more problems cropping up because of my drinking. I became a chronic drinker every day, and mostly to blackout. I prided myself that it didn't interfere with my work. I was in the healthcare profession, and I didn't drink at work, and I didn't drink in the morning, so I thought I was fine. Even when I was told that sometimes people could smell alcohol on my breath, I still had absolutely no wish to stop drinking. I certainly had lots of of pointers that and red flags that now I sort of realize I could have seen what was going on and thought, really, Janine, you know, you're not controlling your drinking, you better stop completely. But all I wanted to do was be able to control it and drink responsibly. And that just didn't happen. I went to a wedding and blacked out at the table, at the the dinner at the reception, and had to be, you know, taken away. And obviously that's really embarrassing. But I went to that person, that bride's sister's wedding a year later, and did the same thing. Even when I was trying, you know, desperately, I was, you know, having an alcoholic drink and then a water and to try and, get the buzz of alcohol but not get drunk. And that was the case with most of my life and most of my days. And my kids were growing up and they really hated my drinking. I used to pretend that I had to go and get something, you know, a bottle of milk or whatever at the supermarket just before the supermarket closed every night. And of course they knew what I was doing, and I would pretend otherwise. I would, you know, hide the bottle of wine in the bushes outside, and what I didn't realise is they were hiding, watching where I was hiding it, and would sometimes get rid of it. There was one night I fell down a couple of stairs in my bedroom in front of my daughter, who was about 14 at the time, and she came to me the next morning and said, you know, is your wrist all right? And I had no idea what she was talking about, but I had in fact broken it badly enough that it actually needed surgery. And that was in total blackout in my bedroom, which was where I did most of my drinking. I used to take a bottle of wine to bed and just guzzle it. I was the one, you know, at parties I would invariably get pissed and either be loud and, you know, think I had all these wonderful things to say or that I was really funny. And then I would find a corner or a bed to go and sleep off my drunkenness. People knew that I would have to have a ride home because they knew that I was the one that would turn up, and I couldn't trust myself to only drink a little bit and be able to drive home. So there were, problems just escalated. I got into more trouble at work, and I had conditions put on me. So there were things like, you know, I had to take antabuse every day. And this is after, you know, me like having to write and say what I was going to do about being, not being a problem drinker. And then antabuse, and then I had to use a breathalyzer every morning before my shifts, and that went well until it didn't. And you know, again, I like just the self-pity that I developed over these years of drinking. It just staggers me now. You know, I was totally in denial. I was totally arrogant, and the self-pity just oozed out of me. So the day that I was caught with a bit of alcohol on my breath, by rights, I should have processed all that alcohol out of my body, because I'd drunk about maybe just over half a bottle of wine, and I hadn't, and that was 12 hours beforehand. But anyway, I was caught, and so you know, more conditions were placed on me, and I kept on thinking, I do a good job. I mean, sure, my private life is chaotic, but that's none of their business. And how dare they try and tell me that I can't drink out of work hours. And in the end, they did. And my GP had said for years, you know, you're a train wreck waiting to happen. And I was just going, no, you know, I do a good job. I'll be fine. And, you know, he offered that, you know, maybe I should look at going to a rehab. And, you know, of course, in my arrogance and denial, I thought that was totally unnecessary. And I thought I'd be able to do it myself when I decided to do it. I was under the care of CADS for many years because of my previous partner to start with. And so I saw about five different psychiatrists, five different psychologists over quite a few years. And they tried to tell me about AA, and I didn't want to know because, you know, I was a health professional, and I didn't want to, go to a random meeting and be with, you know, losers. of which I was one, of course, but I didn't see that at the time. And so I did actually go to one AA meeting, and it was somebody's 25th birthday, and I just thought, you know, this really is for losers. I mean, it obviously doesn't work. They're saying that they're alcoholics. Why don't they just recover and leave that in the past and create a new life for themselves, and, you know, and fancy having to go to this meeting, you know, for 25 years to, you know, to keep not drinking. So that was a one meeting and no more, and I carried on drinking for another 11 years. I got caught drink driving again, and again I thought it was really just unfortunate. That's what it looked like at the time to me. And in the end, I lost my 35-year career, and my world came crashing down because I prided myself on my work, and I didn't have much else in my life by that stage. I'd lost most of my friends. I wasn't invited to parties after a while. Most of my family stopped talking to me. It was everything was problematic. Financially, I was in huge problems. And so I sat at home, tried to get sober, and then something went wrong because I needed to get sober, obviously, to get back to work. And something went wrong, which really should have just put me back 8 weeks in the process. But instead, I just thought, you know, bugger them. I tried and it didn't. And they did the wrong thing. So I just started drinking again and drank again for another 4 or 5 years. And then it was just a happenstance thing that I someone suggested that I try AA, and I was it was actually my sister, and I was absolutely incensed by her calling me out as an alcoholic. But then someone else who I said, well, you know, what's to lose? You know, why don't you check out a meeting? So I did. And that meeting, the first few people, it just felt like blah, blah, blah to me. But then another couple of people shared, and I just really heard myself in their stories. And they referenced my story as well. So, you know, I felt heard and understood, and I certainly felt like, you know, yeah, I do belong here. And so I went back the next week, and I thought, well, nothing else has worked, you know, nothing at all. For 17 years I had massive problems because of my drinking, and so maybe I'll try this. So, yeah, I took it on. Since then, I have had no compulsion to drink for just over 2 years. And, you know, as Martin said, what I find absolutely amazing is that the program gives you such a wonderful way of living a healthy life, you know, emotionally, mentally, physically, if you do the work. So, you know, do the steps, do the program. The fellowship is wonderful. I've met amazing people and I am so grateful for what it's opened up for me. And, you know, finally, I'm finally getting back to work, and that would not have been possible without AA. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Janine. You are listening to the AA Meeting on Air, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. The AA Aotearoa New Zealand has all kinds of ways that you can get help if you need it and find out about AA. We have an 0800 number, so that's free call, 229-6757. That number is it has alcoholics, members of AA on the other end of the phone, there to take your call 24/7. So if you need help, you can call the 0800 number, 0800 229 6757. You can even email on help@aa.org.nz. That's pretty cool too. Now I'm going to ask Tanya to share.
Thanks. Hi, my name's Tanya and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tanya.
And I've really appreciated the messages that I've heard this morning in this room. And I'll share my experience, strength and hopes. So I think one of the things that I've found through AA is we do have some similarities in the way that we felt about ourselves. When I was a young child, I had loving parents. They were very strict and controlling. And I had very low self-esteem, and my family was from different parts of the world. So we were an adopted international family in a country that none of us were born in. And in small town New Zealand, when you have a different accent, you can stand out like a sore thumb. And that contributed to some of the feelings that I had as a kid. But I'm pretty sure a lot of people have those feelings, but what happened for me was alcohol was freely available in my house. It wasn't something to be fearful of. My father did drink heavily. He's an ex-military man, so I think some of his demons came up. And there was always alcohol around, but I didn't feel a need for it until I was about 14, and my parents had relocated us to Papua New Guinea, and I had access to a full bar because I was in an expat club, and I was able to order at the bar. And my first drinking experience really was Tia Maria and Coke, and that in itself was probably a little unusual. But what happened when I had that drink was when that drink went into my body, the only way I can describe it is that I lit up like a firecracker from the inside. I suddenly wasn't insecure or different or afraid. I was 6 foot tall and bulletproof. I was beautiful and funny, and you just needed to be around me. And that's what my drinking started for me back at 14, and I kept chasing that demon, that dragon, and it never really felt the same again, but that's what I did. And fast forward a few years, what happened for me was that I moved from enjoying that drink to drinking more, and then needing more, and then binging, and I'd have 2 or 3 days on and then 2 or 3 days off. I luckily got a job luckily. Got a job in IT sales, so drinking was part of my job. So what happened was, for me, over a period of 10 to 15 years, the choice became removed from me. I would start... some really smart person told me that in order to get rid of a hangover, you have a hair of the dog in the morning. So I went from drinking at lunchtime to having a hair of the dog in the morning so that I felt good and vibrant and vivacious and all of those things that drinking made me. And then that progressed into drinking most of the day, and then that progressed into not being able to work, and then that progressed into... driving, and I have a list of crimes beneath my belt. I've got 4 DICs in 4 different countries. If I wasn't as old as I am, I would have been locked up. And it happened in the States. So I got locked up for a DIC, and I was terribly offended because I had handcuffs on and didn't they know who I was? Which was nothing important, but just a nice girl from New Zealand that didn't need to be in handcuffs, but except I wasn't being a nice girl, I was putting people at risk. I've heard the stories this morning and I felt the same way. Drinking was the last thing. I started off drinking in champagne glasses. My last drink was a bottle of beer that had maybe 2 or 3 centimetres of beer left in it, with cigarettes put out in it, because I smoked at that stage too, because I would wake up and I'd be so shaky that I'd need to get alcohol in my body, and that was all that was available to me. I became unemployed and unemployable, and this is a progressive disease. It didn't start off that way. It just didn't start off that way. And one day by day, it got progressively worse. And I was the last person to see it. I just didn't see it. I dragged a child through this process. I added a few more addictions on top of my alcoholism. I tried to get rescued through men, through relationships, through changing countries, through changing jobs. I tried candle magic, I tried Wiccan, I tried going and seeing hypnotherapists, I tried seeing anybody that would tell me I was okay and you're okay to drink, but I wasn't. And it just got worse and worse. I tried AA. I was in detox in the States. I went into a detox and they took me to an AA meeting and I saw God on the walls, and I removed myself from that room. I had no belief in God. I had no understanding of a higher power. And on the walls it said, if you want what we have, you have to trust in this. And I did not. So I thought I was broken and never going to be fixed. And for me, what happened was that I got so sick, so untreatable, that I cried out to a God that I didn't understand. And I said to him/her, I'll try this one more time. And if you don't fix it, then I'm out. And I meant out. Real out. I couldn't cope with this world anymore. I'd pushed everyone who'd cared about me away, and I didn't know how to live. So that took about 20 years. That process I've just condensed in a few minutes took 20 years to get to. When I got into rehab in New Zealand this time, I was ready to hear the message, and I got well really quickly. What I mean by got well was when the alcohol started to be removed from my body, like I hadn't had a day or an hour without drinking for years and years. When I was able to stop shaking, when I was able to stop detoxing, when my brain came back online, it took about 3 or 4 weeks before I could read again. It took a while, maybe a week before I stopped shaking. It took a while for my physical body to come back. But when I got to the stage where I just knew in every fibre of my being that I couldn't drink, and it took that much to get to me to that point. It had such a grip on me. And once I knew I couldn't drink, then I did what was suggested of me through the program of AA. And I I simply just don't feel the same way that I felt all those years ago, one day at a time. The program teaches me everything I need to know to learn to live in this world. AA is part of the foundation of that for me, but it's not everything for me. I have a world outside of AA, I have friends outside of AA, have things that I do, but AA is kind of like the guidebook on how to live my life. That was the easiest way for me. I can run everything through AA and have a solution. I don't feel like killing myself. I don't feel like drinking. I don't feel like I'm a piece of shit any longer. Like Martin shared, I found a way to find my place in this world, and I'm really, really grateful for that, because my life is full of joy as well as lifey stuff. And there was a very long time when I didn't feel any joy at all. So I'm conscious of the time, and I just wanted to say thank you to you, Rebecca, for setting this up for us and allowing us to share our experience, strength and hope. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya. You're listening to the AA meeting on air, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. My name's Rebecca and I'm an alcoholic. I love doing these AA on air meetings because I get to hear stories from people in the Wellington Fellowship who I, you know, maybe don't always get to see and listen to. We sort of hop around our little circuits of meetings that we go to, and this is always a really great experience for me. One thing that I really picked up on in the sharing today is how the importance of the people who at some point suggest to us, like, have you tried going to a meeting? And, you know, maybe you should check out AA. Certainly, you know, I remember the first person who said to me, have you thought about going to a meeting? You know, they changed the course of my life. I was lucky that friend who, you know, was the first who stopped talking about me and talking to me, her husband was in a different fellowship and had a friend in there who was in AA, and that person met up with me, 12-stepped me and took me to my first meeting. But I had been... I discovered from my internet search history I'd been looking at meetings in Wellington when I was drunk, and like, you know, sort of Google searching the meetings on in Wellington, and I never went to one. I needed that hand of AA to reach out to me. One of the really important ways that we can ensure that the hand of AA is available to the still suffering alcoholic is through work with the professional community, people working in healthcare and in legal services and corrections. The AA Board in New Zealand is there's an initiative to investigate doing a survey from which we might be able to generate some hard facts to give to those people in professional communities. And that's one way that we can help to ensure that the hand of AA is there to help people in need. So if you're in New Zealand and listening to this, ask your area delegate for some information about what's happening in that space. Thanks everybody for listening, and do check out our website. You can find meetings all around the country if you do a Google search or go to aa.org.nz like I did, except maybe you'll actually go to a meeting. Anyway, I think we might close now with a serenity prayer. God, Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thanks everyone for joining us for the AA meeting on air, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.